You're listening to TGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we examine fascist aesthetics on Green Planet Monitor, concern troll the far right on Bubble Pop, and examine No Arms in the Arts BDS victory over Scotiabank on the Orchard Cast. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And this episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collection of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a November 2020 episode, Team Advantage welcomes writer and researcher Moss Robeson to explore the role Ukrainian ultra-nationalists played in Canada and how their activities contribute to our foreign policy commitments in the Ukraine. Now, here's the show.
Makes no difference where I go.
Is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Check out our partner shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. This independent listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage. Welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Brendan.
Hey.
And Tyler.
Hello.
Joining us today from New York is writer and researcher Moss Robeson. Moss has authored several pieces, including a recent Substack piece titled The Canadian Bandera Network, an article in Passage titled Canadian Support for Ukrainian Nazi Collaborators Goes Beyond Statues, and a piece for The Gray Zone, how a network of Ukrainian ultranationalists penetrated Canada's Conservative Party to lobby for military conflict. Moss, welcome to Team Advantage.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So let's start off maybe with getting a little bit into Stephen Bandera, because our topic for this episode is going to be examining the quite strange relationship that has developed between far-right forces in Ukraine and Canada. And at first glance, it does seem like an unlikely pairing, but recent events regarding memorials to Ukrainian Nazi SS divisions in Canada, as well as some troubling issues about Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, have prompted us to take a bit of a closer look at this issue. And what we're going to do is we're going to start with a bit of history about Ukraine and some of its national myths. And a key figure in this national narrative is Stepan Bandera. So who was he? What did he do? And why should we be concerned about his statues in the Ukraine in our current day and age? Or perhaps about his statues and status elsewhere in the world as well?
Well, for starters, he was a fascist, a terrorist, and a Nazi collaborator. And not to downplay any of those things, but he was also a product of the time and place that he was born, which is January 1st, 1909, in what is now Western Ukraine, but historically known as a region of Galicia, which technically doesn't exist anymore. But that was the northeastern part of the Austrian Empire. So Bandera was born a subject of the Austrian Empire. And, you know, World War I started when he was 5 years old and ended when he was nine. So, you know, we can assume his first memories are of World War I. And a lot of the fighting happened in Galicia. And, you know, of course, it was this like unprecedented bloodshed. And he kind of and others of his generation soaked in all this nationalism. But also this region of Austria, the Ukrainians in Austria had a much more higher, you could say, national consciousness than those in the Russian Empire, but then also had a very sort of ingrained positive. The Ukrainians were some of the most loyal subjects of the Austrian Empire. And so there was this kind of ingrained pro-German view, and then very also anti-Polish. This what is now Western Ukraine, before it was part of Austria, and then afterwards in the interwar period was the southeastern part of Poland. And so you have this very anti-Polish, but then also pro-German Austrian movement of Ukrainians that becomes radicalized and also, you know, drifts increasingly towards fascism and Nazism and anti-Semitism and all of those things. And so Bandera, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, was created in 1929, and that was spearheaded by something called the Ukrainian Military Organization, which was created, I want to say, 1920-21. And the Ukrainian Military Organization was a terrorist organization that was mostly targeting the Polish landlords and was kind of geared towards trying to, you know, keep... They also would assassinate, you know, Ukrainians who cooperated with the Polish authorities and wanted to, you know, I guess who they saw as assimilationist. And so the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists was formed by this merger of the military organization with some smaller groups, including, I think it was called the League of Ukrainian Fascists and other far-right groups. And so Bandera was a young founding member of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, and pretty quickly rose in the ranks till the point where he became kind of seen as, he was like the leader of his rising generation of Ukrainian nationalists, who were more radical than the generation of World War I veterans, who for the most part fought on the side of Austria in World War I. And so there eventually came to be this generational, mostly generational struggle within the OUN. And in 1940, it splits. And so then you have the Bandera wing and the what was called the Melnik wing for the leader of the OUN at that time, Andrei Melnik. And so at that's how you get the OUNB and the OUNM. And both wind up active in Canada after the war, but the OUNB network is the one that's still going strong today, although both are still exist in Ukraine and are a force to be reckoned with. And so the glorification of Bandera is something that kind of unites pretty much all the far-right Ukrainians. And so the rehabilitation of Bandera's memory, or just glorifying him, you know, kind of plays hand in hand with the rise of the far-right in Ukraine, which I guess that'd be kind of the short answer.
So looking at Bandera during World War II, what is kind of... his relationship with the Nazis and with the Nazi regime in Eastern Europe?
So today, you know, apologists and supporters of Bandera would say that this was totally just a strategic thing. But, you know, the fact is that they were, you know, very much ideologically, or at least became so by the time that World War II started, that the OUN was ideologically aligned with Nazi Germany. Just to give one example, there's one of the leaders of the OUN, which becomes he goes over to the OUNM camp. But regardless, in the fall of 1938, he was in Canada, and he's saying the world is divided into two different camps. One led by, quote, the Communist International of Moscow under the control of international Jews, and the other is the nationalist camp, including fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. And he even says, in 1938, our Canadian-Ukrainian Democrats are afraid that Hitler will invade the Ukraine and that the Ukrainian fascists are in close alliance with Germany and Hitler. Actually, we Ukrainian nationalists will ally ourselves not only with Germany, but with the devil himself, as long as the devil will help us. And so Hitler was that devil that they were perfectly willing to go along with. If the whole thing was to be strategic, that doesn't really make sense, because obviously, you know, Hitler had no intentions to liberate Ukraine. And you know, there were signs of that at the time. But
I think you're bringing up something really interesting here, Moss, is that Bandera and his followers, and now people who are apologists for him or who are trying to rehabilitate his image, really try and paint this alliance with the Third Reich as, you know, tactical, as, you know, we were just pitting the Nazis against the Soviet Union, you know, trying to pit two totalitarians against one another. But when you really start to look into it, you see that this alliance was quite deep-rooted and quite ideological, as you make note of. And Bandera really envisioned Ukraine as a one-party state with, like, himself in the role of Hitler. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to organize Ukraine in the model of Nazi Germany. And he sort of expected that, like, the OUNB would be able to mold and shape a Ukraine in the model of, say, you know, Jozef Tiso's like fascist regime in Slovakia or the Pavelicek regime in Croatia under the Ustaše. So like there was really an expectation that Ukraine would exist in the same model as Nazi Germany, which means even if there were tactical considerations and being really charitable, let's say that there were, I think it shows that that was definitely not the only thing that was happening. Because, you know, like you point out, they shared the Nazi belief that communism and the Soviet Union was an expression of Jewish power in Europe and that Jewish people were agents of communism. And this is a lie in Europe that was so dangerous and pernicious and deadly at the time that it is the bedrock of the Holocaust.
It gets worse with when you consider that about a week after Nazi Germany invades the Soviet Union and the OUNB tries to declare its own independent state without Germany's permission, and Germany, the Gestapo, arrests Bandera and his first deputy, Yaroslav Stetsko, and brings them to Berlin. And the thing is, you know, it's there's this myth that because they refused to retract their declaration of independence, that they wound up in a concentration camp. That doesn't happen for months until the end of the summer. Bandera and Stetsko are initially placed under house arrest, and then they're allowed, actually, that's even loosened, and they're just restricted to Berlin. So there's a sort of ambiguous relationship over that summer, and the militias that the OUNB created that they thought would be the nucleus of this, you know, whatever, revolutionary army or whatever, ends up becoming subordinated to the SS and plays a serious role in the mass shooting of Jews that summer as the Nazis push east into the Soviet Union and particularly Soviet Ukraine. And so it's actually only after the OUNB assassinates two key OUNM leaders just before the Nazis reach Kyiv that I think it's Heydrich orders, as a result of this assassination of these rival OUN leaders, that the Nazis actually now finally come down pretty hard on the OUNB. And yet the leaders of the OUNB, Bandera and Stetsko and others who wind up in concentration camps, are treated as political prisoners, as are, I think there was a similar thing with Romanians and essentially these other Nazi collaborators who got a little out of hand and were, you know, put in these concentration camps as privileged political prisoners. And then in the case of the OUNB, and other OUN leaders, they're released in the autumn of 1944. So it's all part of this myth that the OUN and particularly the OUNB only briefly had this strategic alliance with Nazi Germany. But then once it became clear that the Nazis weren't going to support them, that they launched this big anti-Nazi resistance. And it's just simply not true, because even when Bandera is under arrest in Germany, or held under basically de facto arrest, he's still encouraging his followers to continue to collaborate with Nazi Germany. The more you look into it, the more you can see that these myths about the OUNB having this anti-Nazi, being an anti-Nazi resistance movement, is just patently wrong.
So from a certain standpoint, the relationship between these groups and the Nazis is complicated. Like, just from the standpoint of maximum historical precision, but it's not at all complicated in the way that apologists want it to be. It's not complicated in any way that makes it you know, inaccurate to characterize these groups as fascist and Nazi collaborations.
There's a highlight from an archive episode of The Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger showcasing your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, muckraking Edmonton-based independent journalist Jeremy Appel's The Orchard Cast harvests thoughtful, in-depth interviews with activists, academics, and others every week, like in this conversation with No Arms in the Arts' Aliyah Pabani, discussing a recent boycott, divest, sanction victory, with Scotiabank selling its remaining shares in Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit Systems. Now, here's Jeremy.
Hello, and welcome to The Orchard Cast. I'm your host, Jeremy Appel. I'm speaking to you from a slice of Treaty 6 territory known as Edmonton. It's been a while. I've been hard at work on my new book, which is scheduled to come out October 20th, the day after Referendum Day here in Alberta. It's called Dark Phoenix, The Rise, Fall, and Reemergence of Danielle Smith. You'll be hearing a lot more about it from me as the release date comes closer. But today I want to talk about some seemingly rare good news. This past week, it was revealed that Scotiabank has divested its shares in Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons company. Scotiabank was the single largest foreign shareholder in the company, which has played a key role in facilitating the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. The divestment comes after a two-year-long campaign targeting Scotiabank. The most visible of these targets was its sponsorship of the prestigious literary Giller Prize. Many authors had pulled their works from consideration to protest Scotiabank's sponsorship of the prize. Spearheading this protest and others is a coalition called No Arms in the Arts. Toronto-based activist and podcaster Aliyah Pabani joins me momentarily to discuss how No Arms in the Arts was able to pressure Scotiabank to divest from Elbit in the unfinished business that remains. Hang tight. Aliyah, welcome to the Orchard Cast.
Thanks for having me.
You are involved with an organization called No Arms in the Arts, which was able to take a victory lap this past week over Scotiabank's divestment from Elbit Systems, and we'll get into some of the specifics of that in a bit. But just to start, tell us about No Arms in the Arts, how it came together, and sort of the role it played in pressuring Scotiabank to divest from Elbit.
Basically, what was happening in the cultural sector in Canada is there were a lot of sort of reactive protests or like one-off interventions in various spaces. A lot of things around, you know, there was Wanda Nana Bush's high profile resignation firing. There needs to be like a portmanteau for those two words, because you're like, was it a firing? Was it, you know, NDA signing, departure from the AGO. And then who's a curator there, their only Indigenous curator, around her social media posts. And then there was, a couple of artists, Palestinian artists, who were censored at the ROM, and, various issues like that in the arts. So basically, after the Giller Prize disruption and the letter that was sent from over 2,000 authors, Canadian authors, supporting the Giller Prize protesters and saying, calling for their charges to be dropped and saying that they supported the cause that they were protesting. We thought, and what I mean by we is myself and Michael DeForge, who met mostly through organizing around encampments. He's a very talented. We got together and we sort of looked at what might be a useful campaign to keep the momentum going with cultural workers. So it was like twofold. It was like trying to unify all the disparate efforts that were sort of like responding to a particular urgent, issue in the arts, but then not necessarily having the organizational capacity or the like long-term campaign strategy to like, some of them were successful, but like after that initial, reaction, it was harder for them to sort of sustain long-term pressure on, say, an institution like the AGO. And then also to think about what would be like a strategic target that we could proactively build around. There were all these groups that were forming, like Writers Against the War in Gaza, Canlit Response formed around, they were the 2,000, over 2,000 authors. They self-organized basically the day after the Giller Prize to send that letter, which was quite impressive. And there was like Artists Against Art Washing. There were so many different organizations. And we were like, okay, what would it look like to form a campaign that brought all of those groups together around a common material goal? And Scotiabank, ECHO, which was a corporate accountability org, had done a lot of work around the Elbit Fund, basically discovering it and trying to do sort of shareholder activism, other like internal pushes to try to get Scotia to divest. I think that was leaked to The Intercept, and they had published a piece about it in 2022. And we just thought, since Scotiabank has been for a long time known as like the way they've done their marketing is by supporting the arts, they've been known as like the arts bank. That's been a big part of their Canadian bank identity. We looked at like the calendar for the year, and we saw that, Scotiabank funded major prizes and festivals sort of covered like a span of time that would allow for it to have a kind of like accretion through the various prizes and festivals. And basically bringing all these groups into a coalition would allow for them to mobilize the bases they had already mobilized toward this common goal to get Scotia to fully divest from Elbit, and also to adjust tactics that were specific to the scenario. And so for the example we always give is, Giller versus hot dogs. So Giller Prize, easier to call a boycott on because it's not something that writers rely on broadly for distribution for their films. They don't have the same relationships with the Giller Prize as like filmmakers might have with hot dogs programmers. And so we mostly asked hot dogs filmmakers to use the stage of hot dogs to call out this investment and apply pressure that way. And there were many who did, including Michael Toledano, who made the all the folks from Wet'suwet'en who made that great film Yinta, and they did it. They won the Audience Choice Award, and then they also called out Scotiabank during that screening. So that's a long answer, but basically, that was sort of the rationale, was that Scotiabank, it's an easy target in a way. It's like bank, bad, weapons company, like Israel's largest weapons company, bad. it's like. Yeah.
Right. And then there are also sort of, I guess you could say all these other investments that are cause for concern that Scotiabank is involved in, that this could, be seen as a proxy for. I'm thinking particularly of fossil fuels. I know Scotiabank isn't the worst offender at that. That would, I believe, be RBC. But nonetheless, and I think that's sort of the power of this divestment movement. It's like climate campaigners have been calling for divestment for, feels like my entire adult life. Palestinian activists have been doing too. Of course, there's a lot of crossover between them. But I guess why Scotiabank in particular? Because there are all these financial institutions that are invested in many different ways in the genocide in Gaza and apartheid in Israel and the occupied West Bank. among, you know, in many different ways. So why Scotiabank and why Elbit? Why was that something in particular that you sought to rally around?
Okay, well, there's several reasons. Firstly, Scotia was the largest foreign stakeholder in Elbit Systems. Elbit Systems is Israel's largest weapons company. I think like 30% of like their output goes towards the IOF. And basically there was a precedent for I think it was an Australian fund and a Norwegian fund that had divested from Elbit Systems over their potential or alleged use of cluster munitions and banned weapons. And we don't like to really push on that point, because what does it mean for there to be banned weapons? Like when you're dropping 2,000-pound bombs on like civilians in tents and like burying people like several, you know, meters under rubble. Maybe that's not a banned weapon, but like functionally, when you're using any weapon like these on civilian populations, same thing. But so there was a precedent for that. And then also what I mentioned about the way our campaign understood its power is that we really tried to press on, you know, traditionally artists are seen as sort of people who can speak out, or they can speak through their work to various political causes. And our sense is that, you know, in this like horrible neoliberal hellscape we're in, like art is very like easily appropriated to whitewash elite violence and state violence. And actually what we need to get back to is an understanding of artists as workers, and that collectively their cultural work, it forms the, it's the material that actually makes these institutions work. Like our work accrued, and the withdrawal of that work actually can bring these institutions to their knees. They need it. In the same sense, like Scotiabank isn't sponsoring the arts because they love paintings or whatever. It's because art is a useful tool for them as well to, like, you know, whitewash their brand. You know, it helps. It's a very cheap marketing tool, essentially. So it's specifically because of those factors, and also the fact that, so our leverage comes from the cultural sector. So because Scotiabank is the arts bank, then it made sense that that's where our leverage lies as cultural workers. Like if we're trying to get people to withdraw their work to force a divestment, it would make sense that we would do it to Scotiabank. And then I think also people don't realize, because people will say like, oh, you know, all banks are even if you think Elbit is a, you know, terrible, uniquely terrible company in this moment, which I do, given the circumstances, like all the banks are invested in them. But
BMO, Scotiabank, I think, has quite big.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of The Orchard Cast. Find the show archives wherever you get your podcasts at readtheorchard.com and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Every week since February 2025, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist, Rachel Gilmore, breaks down the main headlines so you don't have to doom scroll on Bubble Pop. On this highlight from a new episode, Rachel welcomes Press Progress's Luke LeBrun to talk about Juno News, a right-wing self-proclaimed news outlet, quote-unquote, that for some reason boasts one of the biggest Substack subscription rates in Canada. Now, here's the show.
Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop. This is the weekly live show where we talk about some of the biggest headlines and juiciest news tidbits so you don't have to doom scroll. And just a reminder that if you want to support the show, you can do so on Substack, Patreon, YouTube, as well as anywhere that you like to listen. And while we are live, we always leave about 10 minutes at the end of the show to take your questions. We prioritize ones that are asked